Hi, Larry Kleinman. Welcome again to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be with you again.
Larry Kleinman, co-founder, was a longtime secretary-treasurer of PCORN, of Oregon's Farm Worker Union. He remains an advisor to PCORN and also works with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement, FIRM. It's called FIRM. It's the national lobby for immigrants' rights. He also does a lot of movement work, appearing three times a week on Radio Podere, which is a successor to Radio Movimiento that came out of PCORN in Woodburn. He also appears on Radio Bilingue, a national network out of Fresno. So, Larry, last week we discussed the challenges the Biden administration faces has to stop COVID and has to keep Trumpism from regaining ground in the 2020 election and taking power in 2024. And to succeed in these, Biden has to revive the COVID-weakened economy while COVID is again raging, and also while facing what is very likely to be an obstructionist Congress. That being the case, to really have any chance of succeeding in weakening Trumpism and reviving the economy, he has to have support from near the entire left, including the immigrant rights community. And my sense is that to gain that support, he's going to have to take very meaningful action. Indeed, many things that will be necessary to reconstruct this country and, in fact, the world economy. So, Larry, you've been thinking about what immigrants want and need for some time. And after Trump's vicious attacks, more than ever, the bulk of our interview will be on immigration policy. Before we get to that, there's one big looming issue to discuss. And that is, are immigrants bad for this country, but still, of course, we should give them humanitarian aid, or are immigrants actually quite good for this country and needed?
It is the age-old question, Bill. As long as immigrants have been arriving, the question of good versus bad has loomed. It has defined the politics of other eras, and it defines the politics of this era. And the short answer to the question is, by all measures, objective economic measures, the immigrants have been good for this country and they continue to be good for this country kind of on all levels. The public, believe it or not, after 4 years of unrelenting, actually 5 years if you include the campaign, of unrelenting immigrant bashing by Trump and all of his acolytes, immigrants and immigration are more popular than ever with the broad swath of American society. The big challenge, though, has been really three things. Number one, in recent decades, it's more immigrants of color, and that raises the race issues, and that complicates it, as we've seen in many other issues. Secondly, the support for immigration is what I would call a mile wide and an inch deep, politically speaking. There's very broad embrace of immigration. It's only a limited sector's number one issue. On the other hand, for the anti-immigrant folks who are way fewer, it is their number one, two, and three. And that's exactly what Trump capitalized on and drove hard. And so their intense opposition has stymied efforts to move forward with pro-immigrant policies and politics. And lastly, and maybe related to that second point, immigration has always been inconvenient or conflictive or raised tensions with certain groups in our country. Capitalism pits workers against each other. That's a common theme on this radio show. And immigration and immigrant workers are no exception. And so when you play the race card, the worker competition card, the new arrivals who take the jobs from that previously were held by other folks, and there is not an uplifting economic path to carry those folks forward to new economic prosperity, then you have an entrenched conflict, and that also plays out and fuels anti-immigrant politics.
Right. Let's just mention the great benefits that this country now gets from immigration. First, aging population. You know, there are fewer workers per retirees and the disabled. They need more services, and those workers are necessary. And especially in farm work, of course, with rural white children going to the cities for education and social and cultural life and jobs. Some small towns are growing. In fact, most of the rural areas are losing population. and becoming impossible to live in and to keep up any level of infrastructure and services. And immigrants from South America and Latin America are perfectly ready to take up farming in those areas, even at the horrible pay that they get. And then it seems to me to survive climate emergencies and lower greenhouse gas emissions, this country needs a new generation of small farmers to grow crops in the exurbs surrounding the cities and suburbs. And in fact, very few of the people, the young who grow up in America, are ready to, in fact, return to high-intensity agricultural work.
Yeah, it absolutely is right. And there are a couple I would add to that, but I think that's exactly right. Demographic shift is a big driver of the need for immigrants. Aging population means fewer workers. That aging population requires more health care services. Again, another nexus of immigrant worker participation. I would say that while rural areas in some cases are shriveling and dying, others are being revived by the arrival of immigrant workers. And you know, immigration has always been a driver of innovation. In the capitalist world, the champions of capitalism are always eager to lift up the fact that some great number of hundreds of the Fortune 500 companies have been founded by immigrants, including many of the high-tech companies. And lastly, the global climate change, I think, is going to be a huge driver of immigration, and it's going to put a strain on the movement of peoples and their needs and effects on economies worldwide in an accelerating way that's going to make the immigration tensions we see today look paltry.
Yeah, the tensions will increase, but also the need for people to take up agriculture near the cities so that in climate emergencies, which are inevitable now, say the climate scientists, not the Marxists, in the great emergencies that are about to occur, local agriculture will take up a much greater, in fact, it will become a dominant need for population centers, local meaning 10, 15, 20, 30 miles from the city. It seems to me that people who have had farming backgrounds, like so many of the immigrants, even if they've been forced off the land, they would love to do that kind of work. Is that a decent way of looking at it, Larry?
It's an element of it. There's a whole nother show to produce here on immigration and its intersection with climate change, or migration, I think is a better way to put it. That is definitely an element. It's a lane that already exists. I just think when we get into the realm of climate change, the forces are so much larger. For example, I was just reading an article in the New York Times today that projects that Canada will triple its population because arable land will be opened up in the north. And the same thing will happen in Russia. And they will become the breadbaskets of the world, more so than they are today. Canada is welcoming immigrants. It's developing a policy to meet that challenge and to undertake those needs and enterprises. In this country, we're going to fight about it. But we fight about immigration always. When you think back on our history, few have been the times when we've had immigration peace, by which I mean a broad social agreement that we should admit considerable numbers of immigrants for the benefit of the immigrants themselves and the benefit of U.S. society. That's always been an issue in contention, because of economics and because of race in particular.
Some environmentalists say that some of the land, as you go north, is arable. And maybe that's enough. But a lot of the land to the north is not as deep or as fertile or as useful for agriculture as the lands in the more moderate climates, like Maine is not very good for agriculture in the United States. On the soil, in fact, of the whole upper East Coast, it's not as fertile and productive as agriculture in other places. Anyway, that's the argument I've read. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Larry Kleinman, co-founder, longtime secretary-treasurer of PCUN, Oregon's Farm Worker Union. He remains an advisor to PCUN and also works with the Fair Immigration Reform Movement. It's the National Lobby for Immigrants' Rights. We've so far discussed why, contrary to the vicious propaganda by the Trump administration, which has occurred throughout this country's past, attacking immigrants of all types. In fact, contrary to that, immigrants are good for this country and necessary. So, Larry, let's talk about immigration policy, how it has to be changed. Last week, we talked about three sort of areas of immigration policy. Why don't you begin discussing the many issues and what could be done?
Well, Trump, having used immigration as his punching bag throughout his presidency, it wasn't just rhetoric, as we all know. It was actual changes in government policy, practice, operations, resources, in the most cruel assemblage, I would say, of such elements that we've seen in the modern era. More than 400, by the count of experts, 400 changes of significance have been made. And we basically think of it in three sectors. One is the border. Another is interior enforcement, meaning enforcement within the country. And the third one is affirmative status, either coming into the country with status or gaining status in the country. And those are going to be the areas that the Biden-Harris administration are going to have to tackle. And they have an unbelievably complex undertaking. Some of the changes will be able to be made quickly because they resulted from executive orders that can simply be reversed. Others will require administrative procedure, noticing of rulemaking to undo unfair rules. Some will involve the settling of litigation against many of the rules. The Attorney General of California, Javier Becerra, brought more than 100 lawsuits against the Trump administration. Some of them, of course, resolved now, but others still pending. Among others around the country, the Biden Justice Department will step in and start to resolve those. So that's an avenue to make change and roll back some of those 400 changes that the Trump administration made. Some of them will require a congressional action. It is a standing rule of law that the president, the executive branch, cannot grant citizenship or permanent residence. That's something only the Congress has the power to do. The president has limited power to grant temporary status. That's been a matter of contention in the Obama years when Obama used that power more assertively, and there was pushback from Republican governors. That struggle will be ongoing. It'll be renewed now. Again, those Republican governors will be suing the Biden administration, just like the Republican governors were suing the Obama administration. So all of that will roll forward. And what the immigrant rights movement writ large is most focused on at the moment is two things. One is immediate action at the executive level as soon as Biden and Harris take the oath of office on January 20th. And there's ongoing conversations about what that might entail. And the possibility of congressional action, most likely through the vehicle of a pandemic relief package into which some sort of immigration program like status for essential workers, which includes farm workers, legislation to pass the DREAM Act, things like that, would be inserted as titles in that legislation, that being the legislation that will have the greatest likelihood of moving forward quickly in the new administration.
Larry, what can be done about the border? There's so much cruelty going on and murder. What can Biden do?
Well, Biden can do a lot of things. He can restore much of the machinery that existed before, the system of folks who arrive at the border who have a international treaty right to seek asylum. They have what's called a well-founded fear interview by an asylum official. All of this, of course, has been shut down both by the pandemic, but also by the Trump administration. So they could reopen that process, actually give interviews to the folks who have been waiting in Mexico. Being forced to wait in Mexico is something being litigated actually by lawyers here in Portland on a national class action case from Innovation Law Lab. Anyway, they can resolve those cases. They can help or address the claims of those folks. They can empty the detention camps and shut them down. The big question, though, politically, I think, that everybody has their eye on is if folks continue to arrive and arrive in increasing numbers, is that going to create a political crisis similar to what we saw in 2014? And of course, all the while, Trump himself and his acolytes will be screaming bloody murder and talking about our country being invaded, et cetera, et cetera, and that they needed to finish the wall. All of their rhetoric that they used to bootstrap Trump into power, they will be attempting to reprise as a platform for Trump to make his comeback and run again in 2024. It's a thorny political reality that the Biden administration is going to have to navigate.
What about the enforcement internally for people without documents? Trumpism has deported a lot of people. Mary, tell us about the question of ICE and the way they operate. Can ICE policy be radically changed?
So ICE is out of control, no question. So is the Border Patrol in many respects. This has been a decades-long problem. It's much worse now because rather than attempt to deal with it, Trump, of course, tried to turbocharge it. So the first thing that the movement is asking Biden to do, and he's promised to do, is to pause removals or pause deportations. They've made such a hash of it, and it's impossible to separate who really needs to be deported as a matter of public safety and who is simply has a technical violation but is otherwise a contributing member of our society. So a moratorium does make sense. I do think they actually are going to do that. That's a very bold action. I don't think it's ever been done in U.S. history that I'm aware, at least in modern times. The tricky part of a moratorium, though, is how do you restart? It'll probably be a fixed amount of time. So I don't know yet what the contours are of what the transition out of it is. But a useful transition would be the very guideline that the Obama administration adopted in November of 2014, which were called prosecutorial discretion. And what they said essentially in quite a revolutionary way, in my opinion, but not sufficiently recognized at the time, was they gave very specific direction to the ICE agents saying, here are the three categories of people who we believe are a priority because they are a threat to public safety. You should concentrate all of your effort to locate those folks and put them in proceedings, give them their full due process rights. And everybody else, and this was the revolutionary part, everybody else you encounter who you might have otherwise authority to arrest because they have a violation, you are to leave them as they are because we are not spending any resources on pursuing those folks, either putting them in proceedings or removing them from the country because they are not a threat. And so of the approximately 11 million undocumented or unauthorized folks, at least 9 million people that applied to. The enforcement apparatus was instructed to leave 9 million people that they could otherwise proceed against as they were if they found them. Trump, of course, reversed that, but I think that should be put back in place, and I think there's a significant likelihood that it would be. It's complicated because it's hard to see a negative. So there are still cases that happen of people that are arrested and deported. There's also misinformation about those folks. So we frequently dealt with situations where people said, well, so-and-so was arrested and had never done anything wrong. Well, come to find out that that wasn't so. You know, rumors get around. And so people didn't credit that policy for the credit it deserved, in my view. The notion of abolishing or really deeply restructuring ICE is a longer-term proposition. However righteous that is, it's just politically not viable for a President Biden, I don't believe. Whereas taking action like a moratorium, like the prosecutorial discretion, like using executive action to restore DACA, like some sort of what's called parole in place or temporary status for essential workers and pushing for legislation, those are doable and highly impactful in the post-Trump years.
They promised to do a policy of no separation of families.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a bottom line that they will quickly do. Immigration policy has to be radically changed. There's two final issues I'd like to take up, Larry. People are trying to get into the United States and, in fact, other countries desperately because U.S. and European foreign policy is such to maintain their deference for and in support of the major international corporations. They're basically supporting very, very narrow elite in many of the southern countries who bleed the country and bleed it. In fact, the companies get wealthy, as do the domestic elites. Also, the drug policies lead to the creation of hideous criminal gangs in places like El Salvador and Honduras and other countries of the world that make life miserable for the people in poor areas and bleed them of resources. It seems to me that we have to imagine and fight for radical changes in U.S. foreign policy, particularly trade policy, all of the things that have come together to immiserate the already poor people even further in many countries around the globe. How do we think about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. This is, again, an issue just like immigration itself, decades, if not centuries, in the making. And there needs to be a reckoning, a deep reckoning, about the economic structures. My main source of hope for our country, which has never reckoned with it, actively not reckoned, of course, because our country bears deep responsibility for the mess that exists in other countries like in Central America. My source of hope for that is the wrestling with and addressing of climate change, because it is deeply impacting Central America already. And maybe that becomes the sort of overarching framework and strategic context in which a restructuring has to happen, both in the present and with an eye towards a very different future than those countries have had as far as their economies and their societies. It's my hope, in other words, that in the context of deep change around climate change, that we can institute or help institute in a collaborative way, in an equitable way, the deep structural changes that need to happen, that will help to dry up the source of the deep oppression that those populations have faced over decades and centuries.
Thank you, Larry Kleinman. Sort of goes without saying, you've heard it on this show many times, that there's pressure from the elites of the world on all political figures to maintain the system as it exists today. Our counter-pressure has to be much greater, much, much greater, and smart. It'll take really great movements to force the Biden administration to do some of the more controversial things that we've discussed. So, Larry, keep up your good work. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Great to be with you, and glad to join you again and with an update down the road when we see how the new administration and its efforts unfold.
So long.